maybe even outside of America, who bring the credentials that Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz does, it is a tremendous zechus, it is a tremendous honor to host, to afford you the opportunity to learn Torah with Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz. Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, with apologies, is pretty young. He is the director of the Samicha program in Yeshiva University, which means people like me and other rabbis and the rabbis that you know, he trains them. He supervises them to make sure that the modern Orthodox rabbis that are being produced by Yeshiva University are well equipped to educate in schools or to lead shuls. That is a massive, massive leadership position in our community. One short anecdote, I don't know if this will be meaningful to you, but you've heard of Rav Schechter. Rav Schechter is perhaps the Gadol Hador. He is perhaps the greatest rabbi, let's say, living in America today. He's a Rosh Hashiva in Yeshiva University. He is Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz's Rebbe. He refers to him as Mori V'Rabbi whenever you listen to his Shiurim, Rabbi Leibowitz's Shiurim, that is. And I had the opportunity of doing something funny this past Pesach. And the Pesach program that I worked on, we hosted Shiurim via Zoom, and Rav Schechter was supposed to speak. And Rabbi Leibowitz came onto the Shiur on Zoom, because every rabbi is also a Talmud, Talmud Chacham. He was going to learn Torah from his Rebbe. Who wouldn't do that? But what happened is, Rav Schechter had like technical difficulties in the Zoom. I'm sitting there, and I'm just a regular guy like on the Zoom waiting to learn some Torah. And Rav Schechter did not get back on the Zoom, and it was awkward. All those people are like waiting. You know that feeling on the Zoom? It's really terrible. And what do we do? What do we do? So I was texting some of my friends on the thing, and I put Rabbi Leibowitz on the spot. I said, maybe Rabbi Leibowitz will share Torah. Rabbi Leibowitz shared the most beautiful Torah, 25 minutes of Torah on Shemona Esrei, of how to make the most out of our first bracha of Shemona Esrei, totally unprepared. Totally unprepared. There are few Rabbanim, there are few Rebbeim in our world who can teach with the sweetness and the beauty and the clarity that Rabbi Leibowitz does. I hope that you make the most out of that 45 minutes.
Thank you very, very much. Okay, it's great to be in Hank. It's always one of the highlights of my year when I get to come here around this time of year. What I'm going to do is I have a printout here. I'm going to ask you, I don't think I printed out enough copies, but maybe you could share. Just if you could just take one and pass them around. What this is, I'm going to talk as you begin to read this printout, and I'm going to ask maybe if this side of the room can start from the bottom or from the last, you know, they're numbered. So start reading from the last one, and this side of the room can start reading from the first one. Here's what this is. What you are looking at right now, if you have a piece of paper, if you don't look on with a friend or something like that, but if you have a piece of paper, what you're looking at right now is something I did this morning. This morning I went to my inbox and I cut and paste questions that people had sent me over the course of the past, 6 months to a year. And I just collated and collected all of these different questions. And the purpose of doing that is that I wanted to give you a sense of the kinds of ways that the Torah, that Halacha, that Hashem impacts our lives on a day-to-day basis. These are real people, real questions that that people have asked, and maybe we'll go through together whatever you think are the most interesting of the questions. That's the goal for today. So you have in front of you, how many is it? How many questions are there? 11. Okay, top 11. All right, that's a bad number. But, okay, you have 11 questions that came up over the past year. The reason I'm not having you all start to read from the same place is because then everyone's just going to choose question one or two, and then, like, the end of the list doesn't get any love. So I'd like to try to have everything well represented. Just keep reading. Don't feel like you're rude if you're reading. If you're done, pass it to someone else who hasn't read it yet. Go ahead and think about which of these questions interests you, if any of them interests you, and then we'll take a vote. We'll discuss which one you want to talk about. And the idea over here is, again, to try to show, and I'm just going to keep talking until I give you time to read, it's just as a way of stalling, what I'm doing right now. This is what they call a filibuster. I'm just stalling right now. So, but what I'm trying to accomplish over here is that I taught in high school for many years. You may have heard of it, DRS High School in Woodmere. So I was a Rebbe there for 18 years. And one of the things that I found is, like, I would come into school on the first day of school and I would say, I would teach a halacha class. I taught Gemara and halacha. So I would teach my halacha class. I'd come in and I would say, anyone whose favorite subject in the whole world is halacha, please raise your hand. And every single year on the first day of school, if your favorite subject is halacha, please raise your hand. You know how many hands went up?
Zero.
Nobody's hands went up. I mean, if anyone's hands went up, it was a joke, right? It was like, obviously, just messing around. No one's favorite subject was halacha. And that made no sense to me. You know why it made no sense to me? Because there's nothing that is more practical to your life than halacha. Look, I love math. Math is great. But come on, how often is it actually practical to your life? I used to have a math teacher in high school, in MTA. I went to MTA for high school. It's a school in the city. I'm sure many of you know it. His name was Mr. Grossman. And we would, if you would ask him middle of class, Mr. Grossman, why do I need to know this? And he would say, well, you never know. You may need to go over a bridge and you don't have the proper toll. It used to be you had to pay tolls to go over a bridge. It was an easy pass. Now you still pay. You just don't realize it. And the toll collector might say you have to solve this problem in order to get over the bridge, which was ridiculous because you never have to do that. There are good reasons to know math for very different fields that you're going to be in. But one thing that applies to every single person in this room, to every single Jew, and every single day of your life, and I would say more than every single day of your life, every single moment of your life, is halacha. Right? How many halachos did you already observe or choose not to observe today? Already. Right? If you are eating, you either said a bracha and observed the halacha, or you did not recite a bracha and did not observe the halacha. Right? What did you do? What? Fantastic. Okay. And then after you finish, it's going to be a... Bracha achrona. What are we eating? Oh, you're going to bench. Fantastic. So that's going to be a mitzvah d'oraisa. So here you have halacha playing out right in front of you. I see tzitzis hanging out. So that's observance of a halacha. This is something that relates to every single moment of every single day of our lives, and especially unique moments. When something comes up and you feel like you don't have any guidance and you're not sure what to do, and there is a moral dilemma. You know what a Jew does when there's a moral dilemma? We try to figure out what does, what do you think? What do you try, what's the question? What does Hashem want, right? So how do I know what Hashem wants? Hashem is Kel Elyon, he's above my comprehension. I don't understand Hashem, I don't know what, you know how I know what Hashem wants? Because he told us, right? He gave us the Torah. Exactly, what's your name?
Gabriel.
Because Hashem gave us the Torah. So if Hashem gave us the Torah, he told us what he wants. We just have to know how to find it. And that's not always so easy, but that's something that we go to, to our teachers for, to our rabbis for, to be able to help us. Sometimes it is easy, right? Like, I'm sorry, what's your name? Naftali. So just like Naftali knows on his own that he's supposed to say a hamotzi before the bagel and bench after eating the bagel, there are lots of things that we already know. By the way, a lot of you don't even know how much you already know. Like, we're so used to living in a Jewish environment, we don't realize how much of an education we've had. There are times where people are called upon, people who have a yeshiva background, who are lucky enough like you to have a yeshiva background, are called upon to study with or to learn with people who don't have a background, and they say, I can't do it. I myself barely know anything. And you don't realize how much you know. Just to teach Aleph Beis to another Jew, to teach the concept that there's such a thing called the bracha, that there's such a thing called tzitzis, that there's such a thing called Shabbos. There are so many things that you already know, but there are certain things that need guidance. And for that, we turn to those who know a little bit more, who spent a little more time studying and maybe accomplished a little more. Have I stalled enough? Did you have time to read yet? Do you have time to read? No, did you see any of the questions? Yeah, what's your favorite question? I don't mean to put you on the spot. I actually do. I actually just directly put you on the spot right now. 1 second, give her a chance.
Extra tzedakah,
10. What were you going to say? What's your name? Sorry?
Rina.
Rina, okay.
Same.
Your name is Rena also? That's wild. No, you were going to say the same.
No, number three.
Okay, so we're going to start with number 10 and number 3. Okay, so what are number 10 and number 3? So let's read them. So number 3 is, number 3 is the torn jacket case. This happened
last year.
Oh, you know about this?
I have it on video.
No. You have it on video. Okay, so maybe we won't talk about number 3. Okay, maybe we will. I don't know. You know what? We'll start with that. I don't know. Okay. Let me just say them both, and then maybe we'll take a vote which one, whether we want to vote with Rena or Rena number two. No, what's your name?
Benny.
Right. So let's read them both, and then we'll take a vote. So number three is as follows: two high school guys were messing around, and the fighting escalated into a real fight. You know, sometimes it starts as a joke, and then one person goes a little too far, and then the other one overreacts to going a little too far, and the other, you know, and it just becomes, and it turns into an all-out brawl. Not that that ever happens here, but it happened in another high school not that far from here, where there's a lot of testosterone, I guess. So it escalated into an all-out brawl. In the course of the tussle, one of them tore the other guy's $350 leather jacket. The damaged party wants to be compensated. And the other guy says, who brings a leather jacket to a fight? Meaning, if you're going to fight, then why would you wear something so expensive like that? Obviously, stuff happens when you fight. So it's not my fault for tearing the jacket. It's your fault for being an idiot and for bringing a leather jacket to a fight. So that is question number 3. Question number 10, Rena said, is as follows. This one I was actually just asked this past Shabbos. I'm just working on the Shiloh first now. Someone came over to me this past Shabbos and told me they had the following situation. A young boy, Nebuch, unfortunately, was diagnosed with a very terrible illness. And there was a sense that there was going to be a lot of medical expenses in dealing with the illness, in treating the illness. And someone from the community, and this is like one of those stories where like the Jewish people are just amazing sometimes. Sometimes you see acts of kindness that are above and beyond. Someone from the community went over to the rabbi of the shul with a check for $100,000. And he said, this is not coming from me. This should never be traced back to me. But I want you to put this in the account of, in the shul's charity account. And any medical expenses that this boy has should be covered. Here's $100,000 to cover his medical expenses. So the rabbi put it in the charity account, $100,000 to cover the boy's medical expenses. The boy had some medical expenses. He had a lot of treatments. And thank God, he had a refuah shleima. He had a complete recovery. He is now married, has a child or two, and is perfectly fine for over a decade already. He's really, 15 years later, he's perfectly fine. He doesn't need any more treatments or anything like that. And the shul now has $80,000 left in the account. And they're thinking, what on earth are we supposed to do with this $80,000 that's left in the account? This fellow gave it to treat, you know, for the medical expenses for this child. So what do we do with all of this extra money? So that was the shaila that was just asked. And the person who was asking is a board member of the shul. And the shul happens to be about to go through a capital campaign for an expansion of their building. The shul is growing, I guess, and they need to build, or they need to make some, to upgrade some of the facility. So, you know what's a really good start if you're starting a capital campaign? $80,000 is a really good start. So they want to know, can we just take the $80,000 that are left over from this kid's treatment and just use it now? So that is question number 10. That is Rena's suggestion. And I forgot your name already.
Rena too.
No.
Benny.
So Benny suggested we talk about the two guys wrestling. Rena suggested we talk about the extra $80,000. We might talk about both of them, but let's take a vote. By show of hands and not voices, because I don't want the loudest person to win. By show of hands and not voices, all those who would prefer to talk about the two guys wrestling and are on Benny's side, raise your hand. All those who would prefer to talk about the extra $80,000, raise your hand. Oh my God, that's like even.
Yeah, that's raising the hand. What the heck is this? Come on,
Benny, rally him up. Come on,
tell more enthusiasm.
Yeah, listen to Benny, guys. All right. So
some more free breakfast.
Some more free breakfast. More energy, right? I hear that's so. Now I'm stuck. All right, is there another question that talks to any of you? Another question that talks to any of you? That's it. We need to bring in a third option. Number six, what's your name? What's that? Akiva Block's your uncle? Okay, what's your name? Are you a Block? Are you Alicia's daughter? Oh, yeah? Alicia and I are old friends. We went to Camp Misora together many years ago. Oh, that's so nice. Warmest regards, please, to your dad. Pay attention here. So number six, we'll mention number six, and then we'll start going through some of the questions, some of the answers. So number six is as follows. Hi, Rabbi Leibowitz, Akiva Block here from Kehilat Kesher in Tenafly, Englewood, New Jersey. Hope all is well with you. Heard you speak at our old Siyum a few months ago. Thank you so much for coming. There was a bridge that caved in right near our shul during Hurricane Ida. I don't even remember Hurricane. When was Hurricane Ida? Yeah, it was last year, okay. And the street is now closed indefinitely. It has caused many people's walk to shul on Shabbos to become much longer. One solution some people have adopted is, for those for whom it is advantageous to do so, to walk through a cemetery near shul, which cuts down the time significantly. A little creepy, but, you know, it makes the walk a little shorter. We've learned together the Si'if in Shulchan Aruch, Siman 368, which prohibits using a cemetery as a kapandaria, which means a shortcut, and discussed together the interesting question of whether this restriction should apply to non-Jewish cemeteries as well. I was discussing the question with some of my students at school as well, and they suggested that I raise it with you because it would be a good topic for a 10-minute halacha. I said that I would, so I'm keeping my promise. So you thought it would be a good topic for a shir, so we'll see if you agree. So, okay, so those are our three options. So again, we have the two guys fighting in high school, we have the extra $80,000 in the bank account, and now we have using a non-Jewish cemetery as a shortcut in order to be able to get to shul on Shabbos. And now we're going to take a vote, and Benny, to rally up the troops, right?
Everyone's got to vote for me, I'll give you some money off. You know what I mean?
I don't know what you mean. I don't think I want to know what you mean. Okay. So all those who want to vote for again. Now we're going to do this again. This is going to be the last vote. All those who want to vote for number three, which is what Benny had suggested, raise your hand. Oh, wow. All those who are with Rina, number 10. Fewer. And all those who are with, say your first name again, Block?
Kayla.
All those who are with Kayla, raise your hand. All right, looks like Benny.
$10 off.
$10 off of what?
What?
I don't want to. Okay, so let's discuss this. First of all, what do you think? Meaning, before we get to the halacha, what do you think the halacha should be? Two guys are in a fight. One guy rips the other guy's jacket. Accidents happen all the time. It wasn't a total accident. I mean, they were fighting with each other. It's not like he just happened to walk by and it got caught on a nail or something. So what would you say? Why? Say your name first. What's your name? Yael, yeah. Why? Very good. So Yael says one of the most fundamental rules in damages in halacha. One of the most fundamental rules about damaging in halacha is that if a person damages another person, they're always responsible. Meaning, if my animal goes and damages you, if something else damages you, I may not always be responsible. But what's called adam hamazik, when a human being hurts another human being, even if it was by accident, you're always responsible. What do you think the logic for that is? It was an accident. Why should I always be responsible, even if I damage someone by accident? What do you say, Benny?
It is an accident. You can just say it's an accident, even though it wasn't.
Oh, okay. Benny says, because who's going to be able to tell if it's an accident or not? What else? Very good. What's your name?
Grace.
So Grace suggests an accident is something that happens when you're not careful enough. You know, like if let's say, you know, let's take a different area of halacha. Let's say I walk into a room and I turn on the light on Shabbos, right? So when the Beis Hamikdash is around, I'd have to bring a korban for that. Why would I get punished for that? I forgot that it was Shabbos. I just wasn't, you know, I'm not going to be chayv misa, but why would I have to bring a korban? I forgot that it was Shabbos. It was an accident. I totally forgot. So the answer probably is, Well, you're not supposed to forget that it's Shabbos. Meaning, you're supposed to be thinking about Shabbos all day on Shabbos. If you're wearing Shabbos clothing, that's a helpful reminder. If you're whatever it might be, you're not supposed to forget that it's Shabbos. And if you're really religiously aware to the extent that you should be, then you don't make these mistakes. Someone else's property or someone else's physical well-being should be important enough to you that you don't put yourself in a position to make, you know, to accidentally hurt them, ruin them, cost them money, or damage them in any way. So that's what Grace is suggesting. There's no such thing as an accident when you damage somebody, when you as a human being hurt somebody else. If Grace is correct, by the way, what if it's something that's really, really, like no one could blame you? I'll give you an example. The Gemara gives the following case. Let's say you go to sleep. So some people when they go to sleep, like they're just like out cold and they're like a log. They just lie there. Some people when they go to sleep, you know, you've all gone to like camp or had roommates at different like Shabbatons or whatever, right? And sometimes like the roommate has a whole conversation with you. And like we'll walk around the room and we'll like start doing stuff and like, what is going on over here? And like, and they're sleeping, right? People, there are some people that they sleep, go, you know, have very active sleep patterns, you know, they're doing things. So what if you go to sleep and you're careful because you know that you tend to roll over and to like, I don't know, throw some punches in your sleep. I remember when I was in Camp Masora with your dad many years ago, there was a guy in our bunk that when the counselor woke him up in the morning, the kid, and he did it innocently, I think. The counselor said, "Wake up, let's just call him Zev because that was his name." He said, "Wake up, Zev," and Zev went like this, boom! And he just decked the counselor. He just threw a punch right at him. So the next morning, the counselor came with a hockey helmet on and a baseball bat in his hand, and he said, "Zev, sir, would you please like to wake up?" I mean, he was just in his sleep. He was doing that. Let's say I go to sleep, and I'm careful because I know I might throw punches in my sleep. So I'm careful. I put nothing near me. Everything is cleared away from near me. And after I sleep, my friend thinks it would be funny to put something right next to me because he knows that I'll roll over and I'll smash it. So he takes something valuable. Give me something valuable that you could smash by rolling on it. What?
Glass.
Right, so glass vase, that's the case the Gemara gives. Right, so yeah, I assume you knew that, that's why you gave that example. But the, yeah, go with it. So is this a sign? Does this mean something? I know, I'm joking. Okay. That's a very nice bell. Ooh, that's a good halacha question. Number 12 on the list. That's a cappella. I think we're good. So it's also a very sad song. I actually have a shaila that does relate to that song. But let's finish this one first. So someone puts this fragile thing, a fragile vase or a glass next to me, and then I roll over on it. I did everything I could possibly do. So if Grace is correct, you know, at that point, I should be putter. I should not have to pay for it. Now, if Benny is correct that, hey, you just never know when a guy is really faking it. I don't know. Maybe the guy was pretending to sleep, so then he would actually have to pay for it. So we actually paskin that Grace is correct, and that, no offense, and that therefore you'd be exempt in that case. Yeah. So, well, okay, meaning even if Benny's correct, like, why would they do that? So let's say it's not something that would hurt them. Pick something else, you know. What? Someone's glasses. Okay, where it won't hurt them. That's a good example. You have a lot of cases of that also, right? That comes up. Yes. Say your name.
Michael.
Michael, okay.
So they were fighting and they tore the jacket, right? So obviously the person who tore the jacket is liable to an extent, but like the question is what extent? Because they were both fighting.
We initiated
both,
the fight.
Actively
fight.
Oh,
going
okay.
At each other.
Okay, okay, so one second.
You didn't know there was going to be a fight.
Wait, so what are you suggesting?
They're both at fault for the situation that happened.
How could you blame one person over the other? Meaning when I'm bringing my jacket to a fight...
It's not just about bringing the jacket to a fight. The fact that they were both involved in the fight and the jacket was torn. Obviously, it's his fault that he tore it, but it's like he also got involved in the fight.
Okay, good. Let's talk about that in a moment. Yes?
I have a question. Is it like a scheduled fight?
like, let's meet at this time sharp, and then...
Who was the one that knew? What was in the scheduled fight?
Okay, so in a way, it was like first play fighting, and then he accidentally actually punched him in the face, and the other kid got mad, and then they accidentally punched the teacher.
Doesn't sound like a scheduled fight. They actually punched a teacher? I didn't know that part of that.
I feel like the teacher was a lot.
Oh, the teacher was trying to break it up. Wow. Okay. Oh, when the guy got dressed in the morning, he wasn't going to a fight. And he, even when he started the fight, he didn't know he was going to a fight. It just escalated. They were play fighting. Oh, wow. Fantastic. Where did you learn that? Which Gemara? Which Gemara are you learning? We don't know. Okay, but who's the rabbi? Who's the rabbi? Rabbi Selengott, my old friend. Okay. Excellent. Ooh. Very good. I'll tell you a true story. So what Rina's suggesting, very good. We'll get to some of those details maybe, but apparently you know them already, which is great. I'll tell you a true story. A guy I know was used to have this thing at weddings that he would, in order to bring joy to the wedding, he would leapfrog over people, you know, during the dancing. You know what that is, right? So like he would line up like five guys. And in front of the Chasam and Kala,
right now?
And he would take like a running start and like jump over, like use his hands to, you know, catapult himself over the heads of all five of these guys, and, you know, and then dance in front of the Chasam and Kala. So that was like his thing he would do at weddings. Obviously, very athletic fellow, and this is what he would do. Now he was at one wedding, and he thought he would change it up a little bit, and instead of leapfrogging in front of the Chasam. The Kala was not there. It was on the women's side. The Chasan was there. So instead of leapfrogging in front of the Chasan, let's say the Chasan is sitting here. He lined up five people behind the Chasan without the Chasan realizing it, and he leapfrogged. His plan was he was going to leapfrog over the Chasan. Said, "Come flying in," like the Chasan would be like, "Whoa, what?" And then like he would land in front of the Chasan and then just start dancing. What could go wrong, right? So what happened was that, as you know, he was lining up the people behind the Chasan, he didn't realize they put two more chairs next to the Chasan. They put the Kala's father, the bride's father, and the Chasan's father, the groom's father, right next to him. And he goes and he leapfrogs and he clears the Chasan's head easy. You know, he spreads his legs, but he clears the Chasan's head. And his right knee smacks right in the back of the Kala's father's head, and his left knee back in the Chasan's father's head. They both go down. It did not go well. Now, the Chasan's father got up and he was okay. The Kala's father started screaming, "I need Atzala." So the guy's like, "No, oh, no problem. I'm Atzala." The Kala's father's like, "Not you." So a couple of days after the wedding, the guy got a bill in the mail for $1,500 from the Kala's father, saying that I had to go to the hospital and get checked out, and this is what it cost me. And the guy wanted to know, is he obligated to pay for that? Wow. So you say no. Says Rina, no. Why? Ooh, there is a concept that when you're experiencing simcha, you're allowed to push the envelope a little bit. That you're allowed to go a little bit more. Where does that concept come from? It comes from a Gemara, in a Mishnah in Maseches Sukkah. The Sukkah, what's Sukkah about? Sukkot. What does it have to do with Sukkot? The Mishnah says at the end of Sukkah, that at the end of the Yom Tov of Sukkot, Miyad Tinokos, from the hands of the children, Shomtin Lulavayan, they would take out their Lulavim, Va'ochlin Esrogan, they would eat their Esrogim. And Tosel says, no, it doesn't mean that they would rip out the lulavim from children's hands, like they would go and mug a little child. That would be mean. That would be terrible. Tosel says, that's not what it means. What does the word miyad in Gemara mean? This is a Gemara test now. What? Miyad means quickly, immediately. It doesn't mean from the hands of the children. It means right away they would throw away their lulavim. The kids would do it. It was like at graduation, God willing, soon, right? At graduation, what do you do at the end?
You throw your hand
in the air. So at the end of Sukkot, they take their lulav and they would chuck it in the air. But Tosa says, you know what? If they did mug the little children of the lulavim and esrogim, it wouldn't be the end of the world. Because if that was their practice and that's how they celebrated, by making a thing about ripping the love of Minasrogim out of the kid's hands, then that's okay, you're allowed to do that. Because when you're doing something to enhance an environment of joy, of simcha, you're not going to be obligated to pay. So for example, if let's say you're celebrating on Purim, the Rama says this, you're celebrating on Purim and everyone is acting a little crazy, and you're allowed to act a little crazier on Purim than you do during the year, provided that you act normally during the year. You're allowed to act a little crazier on Purim than you do during the year. So let's say you're sitting around a table at the Purim Suda, and everyone gets a piece of chicken, and you look over your friend's plate, and you grab a piece of chicken off his plate, and you take a bite out of it. Says the Rama, that's fine. That's all part of the Simcha of Purim. You're allowed to do that. Meaning you're allowed to push the envelope a little bit. So Rina's suggesting that the same would be true, about this guy that smacked the Kala's father in the back of the head, because it was part of the Simcha. Would the same be true about two guys that are wrestling? Yeah, this is what boys do. We just, we like to wrestle in the hallway sometimes. And if a teacher gets in the way, too bad for that teacher. But this is like what boys do, and therefore it's okay. This is an act of aggression. This isn't a simcha. There's nowhere in the school handbook that says to bring extra joy to our hallways, we're going to have occasional wrestling matches.
You can't just say it's not a simcha to override breaking a rule, breaking a law. You're not allowed to hurt someone else. And on top of that,
but we do say that in certain contexts.
So to what extent does simcha carry?
Good. What kind of simcha? A wedding, it does work for. Tosso says, right, so that's a good question. Where? Right. Oh, excellent. So let's. What's your name?
Yael.
So you told me that already, or there's another? Yeah. Okay. So let's get down to what this really boils down to. Why does that halacha make any sense? Just because I'm at a wedding, I'm allowed to like rip someone's clothing, which Tosa says, by the way, that you're not going to have to pay for that if you rip someone's shirt while you're dancing at a wedding. Why don't I have to pay for it? Why is it that when I'm at a perm suit, I'm allowed to steal someone's chicken off their plate and eat it, and I don't have to pay for it? What's the basis of that rule? So there are two possibilities. One possibility is, you know why I don't have to pay for it? Because he knew. He was coming in knowing that at a Purim Suda, things get labedic, things get exciting, things get a little rowdy. And therefore, there's something called mechila. What's mechila? Yeah, that he, in advance, he's already forgiving it. In advance, he's saying, yeah, I know, this is the way it works. Like, to come prepared, because you're going to a Purim Suda, that you don't wear your best clothing, or that you don't, because someone might vomit on you or whatever. I mean, not to get gross, but I guess I just did. But, not to do stuff like that. Like, to be prepared for that, and you forgive, because you don't want everyone to be extra super cautious on Purim or at a wedding. You know what a wedding would look like if everyone in the dancing was being extra super cautious? It wouldn't be so much fun. It would be like a bunch of people dancing. You know, it would be like the old man's circle. You know, you ever been at a wedding? Like, they have the two circles, one where people are really dancing and the other one where people are faking it, right? So it would be like that. You don't want that. You want the wedding to be exciting. You want it to be fun. You want it to be enjoyable. So everyone forgives it in advance. That's one possibility as to why it's okay. What's the other possibility why it might be okay? What's the other possibility? So it could be mechila, or it could be that what Yael is suggesting, that there are certain things that are such big mitzvos that Chazal say, whether the person is mochel or not, we need a wedding to look a certain way. We need a Yom Tov to look a certain way. And in order to do that, we have to tell everybody you're allowed to let your guard down a little bit. And Chazal therefore say, we're giving you a pass on this one. Now over here, in the case of the fight, it may make a difference, right? If I'm showing up to a fight with a jacket, then it could be an implicit mechila. Why? Because I know that this is what happens in fights. But do Chazal say, oh, it's really important that fights be with as much, Chazal, the rabbis aren't going to tell us that fights have, Yom Tov has to be nice, weddings have to be nice and have to be lively. Fights don't have to be lively. You know what Chazal would prefer if you asked them what a fight should look like? What would they tell you? Nothing. It shouldn't be, right? It shouldn't happen. Thank you, Benny. It should not happen, right? That's what they would tell us. What?
Words are the answer, not violence.
Oh, sure. Wow. I'm so inspired. So, very good. So, So at the end of the day, what do you think? What's the halacha going to be based on everything that we said? Is he going to have to pay?
No one has to pay.
Because you know some of the people involved, I think I'm going to shy away from a final ruling on this matter right now. But
he has to pay. For it. That's my answer.
He doesn't have to pay.
It's not a simple fight.
To tell you the truth, to be completely honest with you, both of those possibilities that we just suggested are valid opinions that Poskim suggests, and therefore it turns out to be a machlokas.
So would you
probably ask? And if it's a machlokas, in whenever it comes to monetary law, there's a unique halacha in monetary law that when there's a machlokas who's right, the person who's being sued can say, I hold like the opinion that says that I don't have to pay. So only if it's a valid opinion. Only if it's a valid opinion. So I don't remember what I paskin in that case or whether they listened to my psak anyway. But okay, so that was the torn jacket case. We have time for another one. Let's do one more. So which one do we want to do? Do we want to do
the extra money,
the extra money one? What do you say? What was number
nine?
I will read number nine. Number nine is... Oh. You learned it? Okay.
No, I want him to say. I don't want your answer.
What's your name?
Eliyahu.
So Eliyahu wants to know about... Well, I'll read number nine. A therapist is seeing an engaged couple. They are from frum backgrounds and everything was going well, but they didn't observe the laws of yichud. And one thing led to another. Yichud means the prohibition for a man and a woman to be alone in a room together.
Oh, at the wedding?
What? Now, at the wedding, you're supposed to do yichud. But, like, when you're not married, and it's just, like, to be alone in a room with your girlfriend and close the door or whatever, for obvious reasons, Chazal did not think it's a good idea to do that. And now the kala, one thing led to another, and now the bride is no longer a besula, meaning they did what they should only do once they got married, but they, jumped the gun. They would be mortified if the ksuba that was read under the chuppah did not say besula, as their parents and all of their friends are from and expected to say besula. Their rebbeim will be at the wedding, and they certainly don't want to tell the Masada Kedushin, the rabbi who's going to officiate. Is there anything they could do, and also any etza to help with their guilt? So that is Shaila number nine.
No,
so should we do that one or the tzedakah
one?
The stuck one. Okay, let's do the stuck one. Thank you. Yeah. I'll tell you something, by the way. Just to give you a sense of the kinds of questions that come up. This is not the only kind of thing that could be in a ksuba that would be embarrassing. I had a case just last week. The following case happened. There was a religious family, very observant, very religious family. Mom is religious, dad is religious, all the kids are religious, and then at some point recently, a few years ago, they found out that mom's grandma was not Jewish. Mom's mom's mom was not Jewish. And they have it on pretty good authority. They're pretty certain that mom's mom's mom was not Jewish, which means that they're not Jewish. So here's a religious family. Mom is Jewish as far as she knows. Dad is Jewish as far as he knows. And then mom finds out she's not Jewish, and therefore kids aren't Jewish. So what do they do right away? They convert, because they're observant anyway. They keep all the Torah mitzvahs. They want to, they're like major members of an Orthodox community. So they convert. The mom converts, the son converts. Here's the thing. When you convert, what does that do to your relationships? So halachically, your parents are no longer related to you halachically. They're still your parents. You still love them. You still honor them. You still do all those things. But like, you could be a witness for their stuff. You know, for their dealings. Meaning they're not halachically related to you anymore. Now the kid was getting married. No one knew about this. It was hush hush. It was kept very quiet. They didn't want to embarrass the family. His mom's just happened last week. No one knew about this. The kid was getting married. And he and his father who is his biological father, his father who raised him, but his father who halachically is not his father. They both said, when you write the ksuba, we would be mortified if you wrote his name as the son of Avraham Avinu, which you would normally write for a ger, for a convert, you'd write the son of Avraham Avinu. So the question is, are you allowed to write the father's name instead of Avraham Avinu? Right? Meaning, because they'd be mortified. So these questions do come up about a ksuba. They are real questions. They have to be dealt with by real people. Truth is, it would be harder, it would be worse if it was a girl convert. Because when a girl converts, she is not allowed to marry a kohen. Right? When a boy converts, you don't have those restrictions, you don't have those limitations. So it doesn't really matter if people know that he's a convert or not. There are very few halachos that pertain to a convert that would be different than a regular Jew. But for a girl, she would not be allowed to marry a kohen. So if it was a girl converting and they didn't mark that she was a convert, they didn't say, you know, Bas Avraham Avinu, the daughter of Avraham Avinu, then when, if God forbid, this husband dies and she wants to marry a kohen, they'll bring a proof from the ksuba that she's not a convert, because the ksuba says her father's name, doesn't say Avraham Avinu. So it's more risky with a girl. But this is a major, major question. But anyway, we're going to do number 10 anyway. A kohen is allowed to marry a widow. The kohen gadol is not allowed to marry a widow. We don't have a kohen gadol anymore. A kohen is not, a regular kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee, and is not allowed to marry a gioras, a convert. So that happens all the time also, where unfortunately you have cases where a kohen falls in love with a convert or with a divorcee. I had one case, if we only do questions and no answers, it's going to be unsatisfying. But probably the craziest shayla I ever got was about 7.5 years ago, because I remember it was right around the time Daf Yomi was doing what we're doing now. Probably the craziest shayla I ever got. There was a guy from a South American country. I was told not to say the name of the country because it's a small community and it'll be embarrassing. So there's a guy from a South American country who is a Jewish guy. He was never religious. He was married to a non-Jewish woman. And slowly, over time, he started getting more religious. He started being more interested in Judaism. It happens, by the way, a lot of times when people think they don't really care about religion, and then they get married, they start to care more about religion, particularly when they have children. Why do you think that is, that people start caring more about religion when they have children? Yeah, they want to pass something down to their children. So a lot of times with intermarriages fail at a very, very high rate. And the reason is, I mean, it would be nice to say the reason is because God doesn't want it to happen in the first place, so he makes it fail. But the down-to-earth logical reason is that once they have children, the woman who said she doesn't really care if she has a Christmas tree or not because she doesn't really care about Christianity, and the guy who said he doesn't really care if they have a Pesach Seder or not because he doesn't care about his Judaism, all of a sudden they have children, and he starts to care about the Pesach Seder, and she starts to care about the Christmas tree, and then there's friction that's introduced. People start to care about religion very often after they have children. But anyway, this guy started getting interested in religion, and he started keeping kosher. Married to a non-Jewish woman, started keeping kosher. He's already been married to his non-Jewish wife for 25, 30 years. They have four sons, no daughters. Four sons, no daughters. All four sons got married to Jewish women.
Did they convert?
No. All four sons are not Jewish because their mom is not Jewish. They got married to Jewish women. And now the guy started keeping kosher. He started going to shul. He started learning. He started learning Daf Yomi. And his wife is not Jewish. And the obvious answer is, so let her, and she's interested, she's willing to convert. What's the problem? He is a Kohen. So she can convert, but he won't be allowed to marry her.
But they're already married.
So now, but they're not, because it's not halachically a marriage if she's not Jewish. So now what do you do? So this guy was learning Maseches Yevamos. It's a true story, happened 7.5 years ago. This guy was learning Maseches Yevamos, and he learned in Maseches Yevamos, and I kid you not, this is just a mission we learned recently in the Daf Yomi, for those doing Daf Yomi, that if a man has, let's see, what's the nice way to say this? You're all adults. If a man has crushed testicles, or otherwise his reproductive organs are severed, he's no longer a Kohen and he's allowed to marry a Gioras. In fact, he's not allowed to marry a native Jew. He's only allowed to marry a Gioras if a man has such a condition. So the guy's like, that's it. That's my answer. All I got to do is... So now that sounds gross, right? But there's a procedure that happens in every hospital throughout this entire country every single day called a vasectomy. and a vasectomy, you're not allowed to do is an issur d'oraisa, but if he does get a vasectomy, he'd be allowed to marry his wife. And he came to his rabbi and he said, look, I already had all my kids. Maybe I just get a vasectomy. And if I get a vasectomy, I know that it's not right. I know I'm not allowed to. But if I do that, then I'll be allowed to marry my wife. And then we could be one happy Jewish family. My grandchildren are all Jewish. His grandchildren are all Jewish. Why? Because his sons all married Jewish women. So his grandchildren are all Jewish. He said, you know, and by the way, the rabbi just added, he's the biggest supporter of the whole community. Like he pays for the whole shul and the mikvah and every, you know, he's a rich guy, he's the biggest supporter of the whole community. So do you turn him away? That was the craziest shaila I ever got. I actually just followed up with the rabbi 7.5 years later. The rabbi emailed me again. He said, I was just reminded of this shaila because we got it back around to it in Daf Yomi. So I said, whatever happened? did he go through with it? Did she convert? And he said that no, he never went through with it, but two of the sons already converted, and another two are interested in converting. So the sons will be okay. The grandchildren are going to be Jewish, but he's just living in sin, meaning he's not leaving his wife. He's living in sin with his wife because his wife is not a Jew, and they would never convert a woman on the condition that she's going to go marry a Kohen, because part of the conversion process you have to accept all the mitzvahs, even the hard ones. And that's like a really hard one for her, obviously, but she would not be accepting that mitzvah. So that was the craziest shayla I ever got. But let's talk about, what do we have? We have like 2 minutes? So, okay, so let's just quickly close up the extra $80,000 question. All right, let's quickly close that one up. What do you say? What should they do with the extra $80,000? What do you say?
Okay.
So it happens to be their initial reaction was find the guy. Right? What did you say your name was?
Michael.
So Michael, find the guy who gave the $100,000 check and ask him. Right? Ask him. Do you want it back? Do you want? They did. They called the guy up and the guy said, do mitzvah semaisim tovim with it. I don't care. Whatever.
Do
that. So does he have the right to make that call? Meaning, if it's all. It was his money. He's already given it to tzedakah. Can you now change the funds from what it was geared to, what it was meant to something else?
Yes.
And this, by the way, this shaila comes up all the time. We're about to have Lag Va'Omer. Last year, I'm sure you remember, there was a terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy that happened in Lag Va'Omer. And in the aftermath of a terrible tragedy, you know what always happens? You go online, you'll always find a fundraising campaign, a charity or whatever. Thing is, all the people that were killed in Lag BaOmer, it's an even bigger tragedy than you can imagine. They were not people who were making money yet because they were too young. They were kids. They weren't supporting families. They were a Shalvim Shana Aleph boy. They were young kids. So they had all this money that they raised. They had nothing to do with it. So what do they do with all that money that they raised? There weren't families that lost their support. So what did they do? Anyone know what they actually did with the money? Yeah, they wrote Sifrei Torah with the money. Are they allowed to do that? Not so posh that they're allowed to do that. Meaning the money wasn't raised for that purpose. So is it so obvious that you can switch the funds to something else? So there is a Mishnah in Maseches Shkalim that talks about what to do with excess funds. And that happens all the time. Sometimes you'll raise money for a surgery and then insurance will cover it. So it happens all the time. So the Mishnah says, Mosar ani, la'oso ani. If you collect for a particular person or a particular cause and there is extra, you have to give it to that person, even though he doesn't need it as much anymore. Which is a wild halacha. He's not even poor anymore. So this kid's like married a little kid and like, you send him an $80,000 check? However, it seems that in this case that would not be the case because he was not an ani, he was not a poor person, he was a sick person. It was a dvar mitzvah. It wasn't tzedakah. They had designated this money for a mitzvah, and it wasn't about him per se. It was about this mitzvah of treating sick children. And if someone designated this money to treat sick children, so what should they do with the money? probably treat other sick children. So I asked two great poskim. I did not have a chance to speak to Morenu Mori Rabbi Hagon Rav Shachter Shlita, who's probably the greatest posek that I know, but because he's in London now, and this just came out mamish this past Shabbos. But I asked two great poskim. Yesterday I had the opportunity, no, on Sunday morning I had the opportunity to ask Rabbi Binyamin Forst, who's a great Talmud Chacham in Far Rockaway, and he said, first of all, thank you for sharing that shaila with me, because I'm so inspired by the Jewish people and that someone would do such a thing. And he said that he thinks they could do whatever they want with it. They could use it for their capital campaign, meaning what? Because he thought that the guy who gave the money has the right to say that since you don't need it, you know, that you could. He has the right to determine what to do with it, and he could even ask for it back at that point. And if he says, do whatever you want with it, then do whatever you want with it. I asked, later that day, I was with Rav Mordechai Willig Shlita, one of the great poskim in America also, and he said that that's true lahalacha, but that's not right. You shouldn't use it for, you know, an expansion of a building. What should they do with it? So you guys said before?
Give it to
sick children. Give it to Chai Lifeline. Give it to someone who deals with sick children. That's the appropriate thing to do with it, even if you may be allowed to do other stuff with it. The right thing to do with it is to take care of sick children with it. I just want to take a moment to thank all of you, because this has been, you guys have been really, really great, and you should have a lot of hatzlacha and a lot of success in all of your future endeavors, and mazel tov on your upcoming graduation.
Thank you. Okay.